Do you just love this podcast so much and wish you could find a way to monetarily support us? Well, guess what? Much like NPR, we thrive on support from viewers like you. So if you love this podcast and you want to become a contributor, all you have to do is go to anchor.fm. That's ANCHOR.FM. Click the support button and choose the amount that you want to contribute each month to our podcast. This helps keep our podcast going, and it keeps the phenomenal content that you have come to know and love flowing. So yeah, what are you waiting for? Sign up today. As always, thank you so much for being a listener. We appreciate you, we see you, and we hope you enjoy the show.
Spoiler alert. If you do not want this film ruined, do not proceed. There's spoilers galore. You have been warned.
Welcome to Talk Classic to Me, the classic film podcast and movie club where I, Sarah Greenfield, your host and classic film enthusiast, bring in my entertaining friends to talk about classic movies or any other old-fashioned form of media that strikes my fancy. On today's show, we're talking about the film Sherlock Jr. from 1924 with my wonderful guest, Susan Kate Heaney. Welcome to Talk Classic to Me. I am your host, Sarah Greenfield, and today on the show, I have my wonderful guest, Susan Kate Heaney.
Hello, you.
It's good to see you.
I know. I'm so happy to see this face.
Okay, so this week we watched the wonderful Sherlock Jr., starring Buster Keaton from 1924. Sue Kate, how did you feel about this film this time around?
Oh, I feel so jazzed and hopeful and inspired.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. So this was my first time watching this film, but the reason I chose this film and the reason I chose to watch it with you is we haven't done a Buster Keaton film on the podcast yet. Silent film tends to be like outside of my knowledge base. Like I've seen silent film, but it's not really what I normally watch. So I'm not an expert on it, but I do enjoy it, especially a Buster Keaton one. And the reason we have you, Sue Kate, on the show is because you have a fantastic short film called Buster Baby, where you do, it's like in the style of Buster Keaton, kind of a black and white silent film with your daughter. And it's wonderful.
Oh, thank you. It was during the pandemic, I was just feeling so like I wanted to make things. And I'd written that movie before the pandemic based off a really bad audition I had and didn't get the part. But it was like one word that I just could not get out of my mouth. Just had to do it like 55 times. And the casting director was sweating. I was sweating. I locked my keys out of the car with my baby in tow. It was a nightmare. So I wrote a short film about how, you know, I did actually leave that experience and come home and then had a screaming, crying baby and had to entertain her with like physical comedy gags. And so I turned it into the movie Buster Baby. I'm just like a huge Buster Keaton fan. I think there's like Chaplin fans and Keaton fans and never the twain shall meet. Is that the quote?
Yeah, no, that sounds about right. And I would say it's like a three-parter. It's like there's W.C. Fields fans, Buster Keaton fans, and Charlie Chaplin fans. And I would probably say I'm more of a Buster Keaton person. That's just me personally. I like all three of them are very fun. I enjoy all three.
Me too. I'm not a fan of the others, but Buster just has my heart. I think the first I saw Buster Keaton short in college and I was just like, oh my God, what is happening here? Like, how is he moving his body in these ways? How is he just showing so much emotion, even though he is like the great stone face and showing quote unquote no emotion, just so amazingly seems ahead of its time to me every time I watch any of his movies.
I agree. And yeah. He really understands the medium of filmmaking, maybe more so than they. I mean, all three of those men came from vaudeville. And so he really right. understands the medium of film, which makes him really successful at it. Okay. Anyway, we will dive into this film.
Okay.
I will give you a plot synopsis. People at home, for those who did not see it, I should mention, I didn't say this. I loved it. So I've never seen it before. We chose this together because we were talking about like, well, what is like a quintessential Buster Keaton film? What has all of the elements. And you were like, well, this one's really good. Plus, I love a mystery. I can't help it. So I was like, yes, I'm into it.
Me too.
The only other ones I had seen was Our Hospitality and The Cameraman. So I'm very happy we chose this. I think it was wonderful and I loved it.
I love detective stuff. I'm a Scorpio. But also, it combines like movie making and the magic movies. And so it's like, I know you do the plot synopsis. I won't do it.
But... No, it's great. It's a movie about movies and it's a mystery. Like, what is there not to love?
Fantastic.
The plot synopsis for this film, it's based basically like a live action cartoon. Buster Keaton, as you had mentioned, he's known for being this kind of like stone-faced stoic figure that does these insane stunts and physical comedy elements in his work. And he directed this film. And I think it's really ironic that this film opens with the quote, "Don't try to do two things at once and expect to do justice to both." And yet Buster Keaton stars in this film and directed this film and does justice to both, thereby proving that wrong.
I know. That felt like a personal attack to me, who's like scrolling on my phone as I'm eating and doing like, you know, so I was like, okay, yes, I try to just do one thing at a time. But I agreed. And it's also about two things, like detectiveness and movie making. So I was like, you're doing two things so many different ways.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I would argue that he does it successfully. So oh, I'm
very
like, well,
successfully. Yeah.
So you can't do both. Just saying. So this movie opens. We find out Buster Keaton, he is reading a book about how to be a detective with a very cute fake mustache. And it's a great opening shot. And then he removes the mustache. And I was like, no, keep it on the whole film. It's great. Anyway, that has nothing to do with the movie other than I really liked the way it looked. So he is a projectionist working in an old time movie theater, which then was a contemporary movie theater, you know, wanting to be a detective. And he's also courting this young woman, aptly named The Girl, as played by Catherine McGuire. Because everyone else has names. All the male characters have names, but she's The Girl.
Mwah, mwah.
Mwah, mwah. So he's, you know, courting this woman, and he doesn't have a lot of money. So he buys her a $1 box of chocolates, but marks on the back, he changes it to $4. So it looks like he paid $4 for this box of chocolates. He takes it to his sweetheart, The Girl, and proposes marriage to her. He puts a ring on her finger that she adorably needs a magnifying glass to look at to see the diamond. Very cute. I thought the ring was cute as it was, but whatever. Perfect. It's neither here nor there. It was great. So his rival, who is called uncomfortably called the Sheik, which in the 1920s was just a term that they used for kind of like handsome matinee idol. That was like kind of a typical term, but now it reads as really uncomfortable.
Very, yeah.
So his rival is like a handsome man who's also very scheming and villainous. So he goes to the girl's house, sees Buster Keaton with her, and is like, oh no, he's given her gifts. I gotta give her a gift. So he steals her father's pocket watch out of his pocket, takes it to a pawn shop, apparently only gets $4 for it, which I guess back then would have been like $60. I don't know. Goes to the candy flower shop and gets her, I'm not even sure what that was.
The most like expensive box of chocolates ever made with like a beautiful woman's photo in the front, right?
Is that what that was?
Oh, the box he gets?
Yeah, I was like, I don't even know what this is.
Oh yeah, he gets the fancy chocolates, I think. Okay. That's there's like the $1 chocolates and the $3 chocolates. He gets the $3 and then has $1 left
okay.
over.
Okay, because I was very confused by what that was. I was like, he got her a picture of a lady? What is this?
Oh, I mean, I was just guessing that it was like, you know, truffle chocolates or something. Okay. That's my guess.
It's humongous. That's too much chocolate. I love chocolate, and I think that that's too much chocolate. Wow. Okay. I was very confused. So thank you for clearing that up.
Awesome.
He gets her an extra fancy chocolate. Yes. The dad realizes, oh no, my pocket watch is missing. So Buster Keaton opens his detective book to the great checklist, and it says, search the suspects, it says.
Yes.
So the matinee idol man, who I will not be calling the Sheik from here on out, saying everybody, he will not be the Sheik. He is now dubbed the matinee idol man. He sees that and goes, oh no, they're going to search me. And so he frames Buster Keaton, and he puts the receipt for the pawn shop in his pocket. And everybody believes that. They search Buster Keaton and they find that pawn shop ticket, and they're like, get out of this house. I never come back. And he's so sad. And so he goes to his job as a projectionist, and he starts showing the made up film called Hearts and Pearls, which he falls asleep during. You know, he's supposed to be being a projectionist, but he kind of falls asleep.
He's had a long day.
And we see him kind of step out of his body dreaming. And that's when all the fun begins. Because he now becomes part of the film. He steps into the film screen. We get this incredible montage of him doing all of these different insane feats with the background shifting behind him that we'll get into further. But he becomes part of the film as the inspector, as Sherlock Jr. So there's a crime in the film. These pearls have gone missing. The people that we've been seeing throughout the film are now the characters in this film. So the villain in the film is the same as the villain in the real life version of the film. So it's all tied together. As Sherlock, he also does some daring deeds. He's not that bright. But at the end of the day, he beats the bad guys. He gets the pearls back. He rescues the girl, sort of. They swim off together as he drives a car into a lake. It's fine. you know, as you do. But when he wakes up, the girl has gone to the pawn shop and found out who the real villain is, because it's very easy to describe him as opposed to Buster Keaton. This was a very solvable crime. Yeah, the guy didn't even try to disguise himself. He was not bright.
It made my little feminist heart very happy because the lady figures it out.
Yes, she figures it out. She's the smart one who went to the pawn shop. Yep. And chooses what she wants. And she's the one who like wants to hold hands with Buster. Like, he's timid. Ooh. And she's like, ooh, I want to hold your hand. Come on.
I love that part.
So in the end of the film, Buster Keaton is looking on screen, which also I just want to say, if he has never changed over the projector, how did we get this far in the film? There would just like be no film because he never, you know, bothered to do his job. Anyway, so we presume it's towards the end of the film. Yeah. The couple's in love on screen. Buster Keaton is doing what they're doing on screen to his love in real life. So in the projection booth, they're framed, the couple is framed, and then the couple on screen is framed by the silver screen, and it's really cool.
Yeah.
And then that's how the film ends. Buster Keaton gets the girl. The people on screen have kids after hugging. And Buster Keaton is like, ooh, I don't know if I can hug you if that leads to children.
I love that moment. It's almost like, there's the sequel.
I love it because it's like, oh, he doesn't know where babies come from. That's right. So cute.
So innocent. The moment of like shock on his face is just perfect.
So anyway, that's the film. Sherlock Jr. It was great.
I loved it.
So yeah, let's get into it. I feel like the stunt sequences in every Buster Keaton film I've seen have been epic. This continues that tradition. Let's talk about some of the stunts that we saw in this film.
And I just want to say that was an excellent plot summary, because so much of the movie is the gags and these brilliant like choreographed movement pieces. And so it's so, you know, of course I know the plot of it, and I've seen this movie a couple of times actually, but it's like I don't really think about the plot. I really think about the moments.
Totally true. And I like that it's not a super convoluted plot. It's very simple and straightforward. And that's why you can fit these moments of comedy in that also usually forward the story in some way. That's also what's incredible about these moments. Like the early comedy bits we get that aren't stunts are like when he's sweeping the trash out of the theater and, you know, trying to look for money in it, and he finds a dollar and someone comes along and they're like, I lost my dollar, and he gives it to them.
But first he says, describe it to me. And he checks against his dollar to make sure it looks the same. Love it. It's just that like innocentness that's we love.
100%. Thank you for adding that detail. Yeah, yeah. And then another person comes and says they lost a dollar. And then we know that he's a good person because he gives her one of his dollars because he feels badly. And then the third man that comes along finds the wallet. He doesn't want the dollar. He finds a wallet and there's tons of money inside of it. Uses the rule of threes.
Everything is rule of threes in this movie. There's also three mustache moments, which I loved, you know, because as a, you know, somebody who does comedy, loves comedy. Yeah, he has the first mustache moment.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, when he's in the car, when he falls into the car and turns around, there's another person in the car. He rips off a mustache too. And at the very end, the person driving the getaway motorcycle rips off the mustache.
I never realized that. And I love it so much.
So satisfying. And I'm like, I was like, saw the second one. I'm like, I think there's a third. And then I'm like, yes, there it is. You know, like I forget. And then I remember. But I was also like, was this the first time the mustache was used? Because I don't know. Some, you know, every gag comes from one of these old movies, really. Was this the first time a mustache was used as a quote unquote disguise?
That's a great question. The only reason I don't think so is because there's the early 1900s trope of like the villain with the mustache in the train.
Totally. That is true. So,
but I was thinking about that with the banana peel, because I was like, oh, he puts a banana peel on the ground. When was the first time that happened? And it probably wasn't this, but I was just like, oh my goodness, comedy gold that now we view is like so corny. But like back then, banana's a new fruit. And the banana peel as a comedy trope is brand new.
Wild banana. Yeah, totally. And then he trips on it. He like tries to get someone else to fall on it. Of course, he falls on it. He's always the butt of his joke until he saves the day, which I so much love about him. And just even like the physical gag of like his shoes are too big, right? Like I remember reading about how he and Charlie Chaplin and, you know, a lot of the silent comedians in that day would wear shoes that were too big because it would like make the audience already laugh. When he turns to the side, his shoes are enormous. Did you notice?
I wasn't even noticing all that.
Yeah.
I mean, he's so gifted that I wasn't looking at all. Like, I don't think I could have understood all the details the first time around. Like, right. I was so obsessed with my favorite comedy bit in the whole thing was actually a smaller comedy bit. It's the first time he trails the bad guy. And the choreography of like how close he is in proximity to the person he's tailing and how they perfectly mirror each other. It was very Duck Soup when the villain throws the cigarette in the air and he catches it.
And smokes it.
But I was like, how did they do that? I watched it three times because I was like, how did they do that?
I know. Actually, I watched it with my 4-year-old daughter on this viewing and she watched the whole thing like so joyously. And when he, you know, the person he's trailing bends over to pick something up and then he has to like very suddenly bend over so they don't collide. And she screamed, like she thought it was hilarious. And I was like, yes, this is for everyone. Like that's the best thing about it. You know, everyone gets, because it's such sharp physical comedy, we can all enjoy it. I love, and how the feet were just perfectly in sync and in time with each other. It's a beautiful bit.
It's like so well choreographed, but then still feels spontaneous. Like it doesn't feel too overdone. Right. And yeah, their bodies perfectly make like a question mark together. And you're like, it's balletic. How are they doing this in sync? How? Yeah.
And he uses what he has, and he's shorter than the other guy. The other guy's like, it almost seems like he has a head on him, you know, but at least like 6-7 inches, I'd say. And he uses that to his physical comedic advantage, which I love. Like, use what you got.
Yeah, use what you've got. Totally. Yeah. And he does. It's like he knows his own physicality so well that he just uses it to perfection. And I feel like what I thought was interesting this time around, meaning like the first time I ever watched it, but what I thought was interesting was a lot of the bits that were in the first part before he starts dreaming appear in the dream sequences. So in the dream sequence, he is also trailing someone, but even when he's Sherlock Holmes, the hero, or Sherlock Jr., we don't say Sherlock Holmes in this, even though he's Sherlock Jr., he's not as good at his job of trailing as he was when he was Buster Keaton. Like he walks into a pole when he's Sherlock Jr. and is more clumsy. And so you're like, oh, even when he's the hero and he's dreaming that he's the hero, he's even more bumbling than when he's just himself.
Yes.
And still manages to save the day.
But dressed very debonairly, must we add, because that suit is just perfect.
The top hat.
Mwah. Oh, wow. Exactly. Chef's kiss. I totally was amazed by that. Like, because he's so thoughtful. And we do dream in fragments of what we are experiencing right in our day to day. Like something comes in your dream that you're like, that's something that I must have seen in The Last of Us last week. Right. I just love that he did put in those bits into that sequence. And I mean, also like a dream sequence. Now we like see them in so many things. We're like, it was all a dream. It was all like he's living out through the movie. But just when he gets up from his body, my husband and I both were like, how did he do that then? Like, how did he do any of this then? And he's doing all of his own stunts. We should really point this out.
Yes.
And they're not faked. Like cars, when he's dodging cars, are really driving toward him. When he falls, there's that famous one where he falls through the awning. Mm-hmm. You know that one? And he was only supposed to fall through one awning, but he fell through three. It was an accident. And, like totally broke a number of ribs. That water gag, you know, there's a part where water starts streaming down in this movie, really messed up his body.
No.
He had like really bad injuries from it because the pressure of the water was too great on his body. It was actually coming down. Whereas now, you know, we'd have stunt doubles and we'd fake it and all of that stuff. There's none of that then. He's really doing it.
And they're dangerous. Like you said, the stunt you just mentioned, this comes after he is running across the roof of a moving train to get off of it, jumps off, ends up landing on a spout of water from a water tower, and the water tower spout turns over and totally soaks and drenches him.
Yes.
I hadn't thought about the force of that water because I was so busy being like, he's running on top of a moving train. That's really a moving train.
I mean, I almost felt selfish at the end because it's like, we've gotten so many little bits and so many little gags. It's like the riches in this movie are outstanding and outrageous. And it's like, maybe in a lot of movies, like one running on a train and getting soaked with water would be enough. He gives us like that moment times 50, times 100, like, driving cars into ponds and just like, you know, leap like the lions. I was like, I bet those are real lions. There's just a short clip. I'm sure they were real.
They totally were. I was like, I think that's real. So I do want to talk about the movie montage, but like, let's finish up with talking about these stunts because they are crazy. The stunt that I couldn't get over was there's a stunt where he's on a dirt bike He's not driving. He thinks someone is behind him driving. Yeah. No one is behind him. He's just sitting on the handlebars of a very fast moving kind of like motorcycle dirt bike thing.
Yeah.
And there's a gap in the road ahead and two trucks simultaneously drive by it. And they show us the shot of the bike going over the bridge and the two trucks that are moving to the other side. And I could not get over that. I was like, how did they film that and time that? This is incredible that we have this on film in the 1920s.
I know. I think like so much obvious rehearsal, but you can't do it till you do it. So it's like, no matter what you're planning, and it's like this exact second you have to drive, that coordination. And now we just like be on like walkie talkie so quickly and be like, okay, this and this, you know, but a way of communicating like so differently than before we had the technology to do it. Like, I am also always amazed by that whole sequence on the bike. My daughter and I kept laughing. We were laughing so hard, and he keeps saying, drive slower, drive slower. And she goes, he's saying it again. And I'm like, I know, because he doesn't know the guy's not there. I have to keep reading kind of. And she knows that, but she wants to say it every time. Then when he finally finds out, he looks back like, come on, you're driving really badly. You're going to get us killed. And he notices he's not there. He turns back around. And then he looks two more times, perfect three. Like, and just the perfect like, double take that you know, need from that comedic moment. Like, of like, oh, wait, it's really, really no one's there. Oh, wow, I'm going to die. You know, it's like that part, you can see his thoughts so clearly. And most often, I think you can see them so clearly by his full body physicality. Because yes, you can see it in his face, but his face changes way less than his body changes. He can do so much with like the tilt of a head, or the slight lean forward, or the slight twitch of a shoulder where he's like, oh, what happened back there? You know,
he understands how to communicate on a camera. And I love the way that sequence culminates, because it's the sequence where he is sowing chaos behind him. Like, this is a live action cartoon. He is just leaving destruction in his wake. He ruins a stag party with, I'm like, what are you doing at this stag party with rope? I'm very confused.
Yeah, like, I think it was a tug of war contest.
That would make more sense. The banner said something about like a stag party. And I was like, this is a bachelor party with rope? What are you doing?
Yeah, it seems kind of in the modern lens, kind of twisted. But I think back then they were really just playing a good old hearty game of tug of war.
Tug of war.
Which was like my gym class nightmare, by the way. But it like gives me like, you know, it makes me want to cry, because I was like, I just take the rope away. I don't want to play this game.
Oh, for me, it was badminton when they were like, hit that thing with this racket. I was like, do I have to? Why?
Isn't it all of it like dodgeball, like trusting children to throw balls at each other's head? Red Rover, I'd always get sent over because I could never break through anything. Anyway, it all stresses me out. But it does not stress Buster Keaton out. And he drags those poor bachelors down the road. And I was thinking about, too, how we're constantly talking about his physicality, and we have to because he is the movie, but everyone is doing amazing physical comedy in this movie. The background actors are doing amazing physical comedy. Like, oh God, can we just talk about the gag that I love too, where there's a clothes leaning against a window and he jumps through the window and all of a sudden comes out the other side dressed as an old lady.
What is also so impressive about that is like what you mentioned earlier with the technical feat of, so early in the picture, not early, like midway through when he first starts dreaming and we literally see him step out of his own body and look at his body. That's a really cool technical feat for 1924, right? We don't see that a lot. No. So what's cool about this scene too is we see inside the interior of the house from the exterior, and then he jumps through a window into clothing. It's like a drum of clothing he had set up and comes out fully clothed. And it's, you know, it was done with a split screen logically in your brain or something like that. Like, you know, it was done. There is a technical, like, he's already wearing the clothes, you know, certain things, but it still tricks you. You're still like, that's amazing. And I believe he really did that. Just like when he jumps through the
lady's stomach.
Yes. The lady's stomach. You're like, how did they do that? And you're like, wait, okay, I can break this down, but still.
I will say that's the only time I did rewind, and I rewound that three times. Cause I was like, there is no, I can't handle it.
It's incredible.
And I've seen it before. I think I also, like, when I go to the magic castle, I cry because I'm really into like, I don't want to believe it's not magic. Like, for me, it's not a trick at all. So in this movie too, when you said split screen, I don't know if you saw my face. It was like, oh, is that how? Like, I don't try to figure it out, because I just think it's like so mesmerizing. I'm like, and my daughter's like, the lady ate him. And I'm like, yeah, I guess she did, you know?
Yeah.
She's like, he's okay now. And I'm like, and yes, he is. He's okay. That's, you always know he's going to be okay.
Yes. Even, oh my God, on that bike scene. So what I love about the moment of he jumps through the lady's stomach and it makes no sense. But you're like, that's incredible.
Yes.
There's the scene with the tractor where he's driving his dirt bike and he looks like he's going to crash into a tractor, but he goes through it. And then the tractor turns and you see that it's a tractor that doesn't have a center. And so I love that reveal. That's so cool.
I just need to say, because we're not on like a video podcast, we keep holding our hands up to our temples and going like, what? Like minds are being blown over here. Wait, my other, like a part that I love.
Yes,
is
no, tell me all the parts.
The car goes into the water and it has already said like four wheel brakes. So you've seen that. So you know something's going to happen. So he brakes and then the top of the car and him and his sweetheart go sailing into a big lake or whatever. And he's sort of still, quote unquote, driving the car. And he makes the left turn signal with his hand. Even though he's in a lake, there's clearly no other cars. The car is sinking. And he does that. So for me, it's like the creativity of those little moments. Because like, I love a gag, right? Like I love creating them in my work. I love, and then the specificity that he finds in it. I'm like, I have so much more to learn. You know, like it's like not only the gag, but then it's the tiniest gesture that he makes to say, oh, I'm going to be making a left now. He turns the car around and it's never like a wink, wink, nudge, nudge. It's just, he's so living in it.
I did not even notice that detail because I was so focused on all of the other, like I was focused on the how of how they did that. And I'm so glad that we have these minds where they work. You can tell me like, no, there's this detail that he was doing. Whereas I'm like looking at it being like, okay, so I think they made that a boat. I think that's a boat that they turned into. Yep, that's a boat. That's a boat. And then when he puts the sail up, brilliant. He turns the convertible top into a sail.
We're a good team because we're seeing it from two totally different perspectives. Yeah.
But yeah, I didn't notice the left-hand turn. I will say I did notice when the boat is sinking, I literally saw the holes that they had poked in the bottom of the boat. The water gushes through a series of holes in the bottom. Cause yeah, I was just like, how are they doing this? So it was so cool. Yeah. So they really took a boat, really turned it into a car, really sunk it by putting holes in the bottom. You could look at that at home, people, but then also make sure you check out Buster Keaton.
Making the left turn signal. Yes. I mean, I think it's the left. It could be a right. I learned to drive a few years ago. I'm a terrible driver. So he makes the gesture for a turn.
That's great.
Check it out again. Yeah, it's a great moment. It's great.
Oh, one of the best stunts, a very good stunt, is when the dirt bike scene. So we have this insane dirt bike chase. He has gone through everything that you could possibly go through on a dirt bike. It ends with him rescuing the girl that he wanted to rescue. So the girl in the movie is the same as his sweetheart in real life in the film. The bike stops abruptly and shoots him through the window, where we see a scene where like there's a lecherous man that might do harm to this woman. And you're like, oh no, I'm afraid for you.
Yeah. Oh, he starts to take off like a tie or something. I'm like, oh no.
No, no, please don't.
Yeah, don't.
But Buster Keaton shooting through the window, he goes feet first and his feet knock the man out the other window. The man falls down. He saves the day. And he and the girl escape through the window. And while he's rescuing her, he still knocks her over by accident in a pratfall. And
totally.
It's great.
Yes, I know. I love that too. We haven't even really even talked about those, because then there's two villains in the movie, right? So then there's like the villain guy who tries to get the girl at the beginning from Buster. And there's the accomplice. Like he has this accomplice character. And I like that scene has never, you know, struck me as my favorite before until today. I really loved it so much. It's they're trying to kill Sherlock Jr. because he's, you know, a great. And I love that it's like the world's best detective. There's such an optimism in these movies for me. Buster himself is like, I don't want to say a failure, but a flop a little bit. He's like doesn't have enough money for the good chocolates, right? Buster as a detective, even though he's a mess, is the world's best detective, right? There is a hopefulness to all of it.
I do want to share the quote. I loved that they're like, he's the best detective. And then they're like, by the next day, the mastermind had completely solved the mystery with the exception of, what did I write? Oh no, I can't read my own writing. With the exception of something, the pearls and finding the thief. What would that say?
With the exception of finding the pearls and who did it, basically. Yeah, he's figured everything out except the two main parts of the thing.
Uh-huh. So he's the best. Well, he didn't solve it and that's fine. And he didn't find who did it and what it was. But he's the best.
Comedically perfect. So in that scene, they're trying to find all the different ways they can to kill him, right? Like there's like a trick chair where if you sit on it, an axe comes down and, I don't know, cuts you in half, I guess, something horrific. There's a game of pool that they're like, oh, we'll challenge him to pool. And there's the 13 ball blows up if you hit it or whatever. And there's poison.
The rule of threes. Oh my God.
Oh, it's everywhere. It's everywhere in this, you know, as like an actor, it's like a master class in like making sure that you do threes and that they're all have their own flavor to them, right? Like, so, and I love that the poison shots, by the way, were like literally shots. It seemed like, I don't know, some sort of very fruity beverage. They were maybe absinthe. I don't know what they were drinking.
Oh, I thought it was a dark rum.
My mind was like going to some sort of was like, maybe it's a mind eraser. What are they drinking? I don't know. Anyway, but they of course can't kill him, and all of their gags go so horribly wrong, and they almost kill themselves so many times. But I love they're in the other room, because every time he kind of hits a pool ball, they scurry into the other room because they're so scared that it's going to have the explosion. And then one of the bad guys is describing to the other bad guy like what he did in the pool game, and I find that scene so satisfying. He's hitting the ball, we see it, and then with his hands only, he's explaining what happened, where the ball went. It's just so little and so minuscule, but it's just really funny and silly.
Also, okay, so here we have a common theme of you being like, here's this gorgeous moment, and me being like, but how did they do that? I was like, was he an expert pool player? How is he not hitting that ball? It's incredible.
He can do everything. I don't know. It is so funny because it's really making me realize, like, I just accept things. Like, I don't know how a fax machine works. And I remember my husband saying, like, well, I can explain it to him. Like, don't. Because it seems so amazing. I can draw you a picture and send it to you. And he's like, what do you think about the internet? I was like, stop. I can't even think about it. You know, like, I can't even.
Yeah.
It's just, I like to be swept up in it, I guess. So it is good that we have both of these perspectives. Because if it was just me recording this podcast, it would just be like, la, la, la. And you're like, here's the gag and how it happened. So that's important. I think it's important.
Well, because he is playing like a master pool player. Like when he makes the ball jump over the other ball, I was like, I think this is really you doing this. How incredible that you have this skill set as well. Yes. This is so masterful of like yet another physical craft you can do. Oh my God.
Right. And I also feel like for him, and maybe this is just me projecting, but whatever he can't do, he would go and learn. And I feel like he probably plays always in like, you know, on a tightrope. Like he's probably always like, this scene would be great. I will learn this pool trick to make it happen. Like, I don't think he would ever be like, you know what? I can't do that. So I'll like lessen the gag for myself.
Ooh.
Right? I think he would always be like, I want it to be as the complicated and difficult as it can be. It's almost like an Evel Knievel. Is that the guy who jumps off of things?
Yes, it is.
You know, like it almost has that flair to some of his work. That's like, he's really unafraid. You know how he had the name Buster? Do you know this?
No, tell me.
He was like a child of vaudeville parents, and they used to throw him around the stage, like really. And they said, like, he's a buster. He can get like busted up and come right back for more.
Yeah.
So it comes from, in a way, like a little bit of a dark place that his family was just kind of using his small child body for a comedy. Though I made a comedic movie with my daughter, but I keep her body very safe in the movie. Yeah. No throwing.
You never once threw her.
I never did. No, and I never will. But yeah, his parents, there was vaudeville, and they were like, and he would like fall downstairs as a child, and they would like literally be like just doing crazy things with him. So that's how he got the name Buster.
I did not know that. I actually don't know a lot about him. I know that he came up from vaudeville and got his start in Hollywood and directed his own stuff. And I know that people say his work was the best through 1929 when he was directing his own things and had the most control over his work. Mm. And then once he signed with MGM and lost control of his work, he couldn't like capture that same magic. And that's also when he like, you know, his marriage ended and he became an alcoholic, struggled with alcohol addiction. And especially like at that point on, I know that he has kind of a comeback in the 40s and 50s.
Yes.
He's in Sunset Boulevard.
I know. I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he's never able to recapture.
Right. And I wish I could have seen what he would have done later as like somebody whose body was changing.
Yeah.
You know, I think we were kind of robbed of that, like of getting to see what an older body might be able to do stunt wise. And even like as new technology was coming, what he could have dreamed up for stunts.
Oh,
I know.
It would have been incredible. I know that he did work with like Lucille Ball and like was kind of a coach for her and for other comedians in like sitcom land.
And isn't that a dream? Can you imagine the two of them just playing and doing their business together?
Like how wonderful. Two comedy masterminds working together.
Yes. If you haven't seen it, this is for everyone. The Great Buster is an amazing film by Peter Bogdanovich, who is a huge Buster Keaton fan. And it's just really shows some of his like greatest stunts and greatest gags and stuff like that. So yeah
check it out, everybody.
Yeah,
I want to make sure we talk about this movie montage that we've mentioned several times because it's incredible. If you watch one part of this film, make sure it's this movie montage. The part we're specifically referring to, I'll break it down for you and then we can chat about it. It's when Buster Keaton is dreaming. He dreams that he steps into the silver screen, gets kicked out of the silver screen. And I was again wondering, how did they do that? But it's okay.
He's in the movie and he's like back in the theater and in the movie, back in the theater. Probably happened 3 times. I'm not sure.
They did a stage for, like, I think the first part's like a physical stage. And then I think it does switch over to the movies once he's like actually in it. Oh. That's what I've decided for myself. Okay. But anyway, so he ends up entering the film and all of these backgrounds keep switching on him. So he'll be in one position, like he'll be looking over something. And then the next slide that happens behind him, he's on a mountain and he's gonna fall over the mountain. Oh no. Yes. And then it switches again, and then there's lions, real lions.
Yes.
It ends up he's in the desert, he's in the snow.
Yeah, he's jumping off a rock into the ocean, and then he lands face first in the snow and his legs are kicking up in the air, and the music is just perfect because there's like a live orchestra, as we wish all movies still had. And the music is playing like Happy Trails when he's sort of in the, you know, deserty cowboy scene. And it's playing a Christmas song when he's in the snow.
Oh, I don't think mine was that. I think we might have had different scores.
Wait, what? Today I watched the 50s recreation.
Oh, so I watched a different one than you did. I watched a newer restoration. And the score that I heard was recorded in 2015, recorded and composed. So I think we probably watched it with different scores. But my score was awesome. I was so into it.
Wow.
So yeah, that's like a new modern thing of like recreating scores. Like I saw almost a decade ago at Turner Classic Movies Fest, I saw The Lodger, Hitchcock's silent film, with a new score that was performed live for us.
Whoa.
And it was so cool. But yeah, the score can do so much for a film, but I had not considered that we might be watching different scores.
I'm so happy we realized this. Yeah. That's wild.
Yeah.
Oh, I found it so tongue-in-cheek and playful, and just it was so light and sweet. Like it just informed the mood so easily. I love that montage. Yeah. I love a montage.
And this is seamless. Like I don't, nowadays I think we would still mess this up. Like he does it picture perfect, where each scene where it takes up, he looks, I think the only time you can really see the light change where it doesn't totally match is when he ends up in daytime in a street. But I remember being like, okay, so the light shifted there, whatever, it's fine. Okay, I don't care. But yeah, he perfectly seamlessly blends all of these pieces to make it really look like he is the constant and the background is shifting.
Right.
That's incredible.
It's incredible. It almost looks like a flip book for me in that part, you know, like it's like, we're in a new land. And he's just the character walking through all the scenes. I mean, if you were watching back then, which it's my dream to like go to the movie theater and see a double feature in the '20s and get plates.
Oh, my grandma had the plates.
Oh yeah. Mine too. And do you think that people were watching? I mean, they were screaming, laughing. I know that, you know, I know that. And do you think they were also watching with like awe? Like how did he do this? Or do you think that, you know, I don't know, I guess what would the feeling be? Or do you think it would be like how you and I both are having different feelings, like you're figuring out how it's happening and I'm just like, whoa, you know?
What's so interesting about this film to me is it still feels contemporary in a lot of ways.
Yes.
And so I think that they must have felt that back then. I mean, these movies were such big hits, so they must have felt like they were watching something new and exciting. And it's like the way I would say it's like, you know how people go to see action films now when real people are doing the stunts. So part of the draw of like a Mission Impossible film is, you know, that Tom Cruise is really doing that thing. He's really holding on to that plane while it's taking off. Right. Buster Keaton was doing that a million times in one movie. He was doing these insane physical stunts himself. So I think that always, the excitement of that can't help but get to you. That's why those Mission Impossible movies are a hit. And that's why these are hits, because you can't help but feel excitement and fear and all of the things when you know someone's actually doing that very daring stunt.
I love that. Yes. It's like, you can't deny that it actually is a tightrope. Yeah. It actually could go wrong. And you know,
it could go wrong.
Yeah. Wow. Uh-huh. I love that.
I remember thinking, I used to have a false story in my head about Buster Keaton. I remembered back when the first Buster Keaton film I saw was Our Hospitality, and I saw it in college in a film class. Mm-hmm. And I made up a story. I think I thought I heard this, but then I researched and was like, this is not true. But I thought that he had died on a set. Like I thought he had died from a stunt accident. That was what my little baby brain thought until like maybe 10 years later when I was researching and then went, oh no, he continued to live and he had like all of these other things. But that just made sense to me. Witnessing those stunts, whatever it was that sparked that, I remember thinking like, that is so dangerous. It makes so much sense to me if that were the case for him.
I think it is the awning one that the water one really messed up like his neck and vertebrae, and you know, but I think it was the awning one where he was supposed to fall through the one and then he went through the three that he kept in the movie because it was so funny or like so amazing, right? Like he kept it in and that was like, this is like the worst thing that's ever happened to me. but he did get really messed up from it. So all of that was true. So you, I think you just heard that and you turned it into like death.
I'm sure. Especially because again, our hospitality, I feel like if I haven't seen it in what, almost 20 years, but if I remember correctly, he's dangling from a real waterfall, right?
Yeah.
There's like a branch over an actual live giant waterfall.
Oh, so you thought that was the movie that had happened?
I don't know if I thought that was the movie, but I remember seeing that thinking like, well, of course that's how he dies. Like, of course. He's doing stunts like this. How could he survive? How could a person survive? Yeah.
And then he did disappear, you know, for all like film. Yeah. So it makes sense. Thank God he didn't.
Yeah. But I want to very much clarify for the audience at home. He did not die from these stunts. This was like the Mandela effect of me and my Buster Keaton brain. Like, this is not real.
It's the Berenstain Bears moment where we just never know how we say it. Yeah.
Yes. It is not Jiffy. It has never been Jiffy. Peanut butter is Jif or Skippy. There you go.
That's weird. I think it's Jiffy. But I know it's not. I get it.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. So now that I have like experience with film, two things I want to say. One, the one I watched was a restoration of an interpositive. And I know all about film now because now I work with film. So I was like, oh my gosh, I know what that means. And I love that like I'm already, before this movie has started, I'm thinking about how film is made and what film is. And what that means is that back in the day, when we used film a lot, so film, when you first make it, it's a negative, right? And a negative has to become a positive. And a positive, what we watch in a movie theater is a print. That's the positive that's made off of a negative. However, it's bad for the negative to keep making copies off of it. So you use something called intermediary elements. And an interpositive is what you make off of a negative so that you can make an internegative off of the interpositive. And the internegative is what you make the actual prints of the movie off of.
Wow.
So we save all of those in the film archive. But they were talking about all the different sources that they used. So they used mostly an interpositive, a little bit of an internegative, and a print to make this final restoration. They needed all of these pieces to make this film look as good as they possibly could. And I also thought it was interesting, side note, back in the day, if it was black and white, it wouldn't be called an interpositive and internegative. It would be a fine grain and a dupe negative. So people at home, ooh, go with that knowledge. So that's a whole side note of that.
Yeah,
but
I love
then
that.
I was watching this when he was the projectionist and I was like, oh God, there's so many things that are wrong that are happening here.
Oh, okay.
Like one, that is nitrate film he is using. Okay. So nitrate film was used, I want to say until like the early 30s. And it was incredibly highly flammable. Like it is like tinder. It's like kindling. Okay. It's, if you've seen, Inglourious Basterds, spoiler alert.
Oh yeah.
When they set the theater on fire and it, you know, that's what nitrate does. Okay. So anyway, it's highly flammable. They do not allow it to be used today. When we have it at the archive, we have to put it in a special locker so it can go to its safe archival home outside of our facility. It has caused so many fires. It's really unsafe. So he's handling it like it's nothing. It's not even in a film can. Yeah. And he falls asleep while it's projecting, which I'm like, everyone could die here. And he isn't awake to. So when you're handling projectors all back in the day, and probably now when you're showing film, you had two projectors. One had the first reel, the other had the second reel. And you would change over projectors. Once you see cue marks in the right corner, you know it's time to switch over to projectors. You start the other projector and then reload the first projector so you can go back and forth and show the whole movie without stopping. I've been to a screening where the second projector broke and they're like, we're so sorry. We're going to have to like rethread the projector. It'll take about 5 minutes and we're just going to do that the whole film. We're sorry.
Oh, wow.
So about every 11 minutes or so, it takes about 11 for sound films, 15 for silent films to run its course. I'm sorry. This might be very boring.
No, I'm enjoying that.
But anyways, I was just watching his projector things. And a lot of times archivists get upset with projectionists because they don't handle film as delicately as we would, because their whole purpose is like, we're just going to show it. We don't really care what happens to it. And the archivists are like, oh, please don't hurt it. Please don't scratch it. Please stop. What are you doing? And he's not even looking at the screen to know when the cue marks are going to happen. He's just not handling the film with care. They're like, out and about, it's highly flammable. He could do a better job as a projectionist. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay. Was it bothering you? Like
a little bit. Cause I was just like, take better care of that film. Someday we might need it.
I know. Okay.
They
I hear
used
you.
To send copies to a company that would shred them because of IP stuff, because of intellectual property. They didn't want a bunch of these films to exist, so they would destroy them. And there was a company that like did that. And now that film was like precious and we don't have as many prints of things, I'm like, oh, why? Why did we not have foresight?
This is kind of still happening in a very obscure way, but there's this one Twitter person I'm following who's like, I have a copy of Squirrel to the Nuts, Squirrel something to the Nuts. I don't know. Can't remember. I think it's Peter Bogdanovich, perhaps. And he says he has the last copy of the movie. And he's like, fly me to LA and I'll show it. But he's like, no one's willing to fly me. And I'm like, constantly tweeting at the New Beverly, like, don't you want to show this movie? Like, it's like, he says he has the only copy of it. So there's something so romantic and stressful about this to me. Like, what if that copy goes away? What if he checks his luggage?
We need to make copies of that copy. It can't be the only copy. Oh, that feels stressed. We need to make an interpositive.
I'm going to put you two in touch.
Okay, thank you. Unless he has the print, and then we're going to make an internegative. It's going to be a thing.
It's Twitter. I don't know what he has, but I do know that I'm like enjoying the journey.
Yeah, because I'm like, no, if it's the only one, you should not show it. That would be bad for the film. That would hurt it. It would be bad. You know, every time you show film, it loses a little something. So as someone who loves to watch real film and someone that also tries to protect it and save it, it's like this mix of like, I'm so happy I'm watching this, but I also know that it's hurting it, but this is its purpose. It's a whole thing.
It's just so romantic, isn't it?
It is.
It really is. Yeah. If you overwatch it, it loses a little something. Oh God.
It does.
Too much.
Anyway, okay. Thank you for letting me go on that whole other side note.
Thank you for teaching me.
All right. So we are going to head into the modern lens portion of this show. What did not hold up? I mean, you had said something very well earlier about the woman is like she's the detective. She's the only one that successfully like really does solve a crime in real life here.
Yeah. And I really loved her performance, by the way. I thought she was really fun and said so much with so little and really conveyed how she felt at all times. I thought she was great.
But like what did not hold up? I mean, the titling of The Sheik, obviously that feels a bit racist.
Yeah, that needs to go. That's terrible.
Yeah. So I didn't love that. There's also like, obviously there are no people of color, unfortunately, in this film. It's a bunch of white people.
Yes.
You know, there's no representation for a lot of diversity in this film.
I know. And I think when she was doing stunts, I thought they were excellent. So I thought it didn't hold up that she didn't get to do more.
Yes.
She had such a small role, really, for the female lead of this movie, the girl, and no name, as you pointed out, which, you know, let's name our characters, everyone, as somebody who writes as well as acts. It's like, you know, if I get something called like Anthony's mom and it's like six pages, I'm like, you need to give this woman, like, she's Lydia in my mind, but you also need to give me Lydia in the credits because you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny because literally all of the men have names in this. So, we have even the boss. Oh, something we didn't mention earlier is the boss in real life is very curmudgeonly. He behaves, you know, rudely to the projectionist, but then in the dream he's the foil of the projectionist, he's the assistant, he's his right-hand man. So I loved that, but like even he has a name, all of the men have names, and they're shown to us on a title card. They're like, we want you to know these people's names. But the girl never given a name,
and they refer to her as your sweetie even in the movie, right? They could just give her a name and everyone could use it, I think. So that doesn't hold up.
And Buster Keaton, his like real life character is not given a name. His name in the movie is Sherlock Jr. So technically, I guess he doesn't totally have a name, but I still think they could give her a name.
Yeah, agreed.
It's like, what's her name that was in Bring It On? She's amazing. Gabrielle Union. It's like how she was like, my character was a huge part of that film and my character does not have a last name. All of the white girls' characters have a last name. Wow. Mine does not. And to me, that's like very telling of how we're telling the story.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Yeah, we definitely, I think now we do know better and we need to do better about all of that.
We mentioned, I did like that she has agency, this woman. I call her the woman. The movie calls her the girl.
I know. It's like the sweetie, the woman, the girl. I don't know. What are we calling her?
I was jokingly noting the 13 ball and how they set it off and explode the backyard and the trees and nobody else notices or cares. He's like, let me show you this grenade 13 ball and what it can do. Explodes in the backyard, not a peep.
No sound effect either. Yeah, that's interesting.
Love that it's an easily traceable crime. That doesn't, I think it's so silly, all of that, where you're like, you're not a real criminal. That's funny.
Yep.
I wondered what happened to the guy after. I was like, does he go to jail for stealing? What happens to the bad guy?
I know. I was also following because, you know, he leaves the bad guys in the movie story, just in the kind of desert with no car because the car explodes, right? So then they, I guess, I'm like, I kept thinking, how did they get home? Like, I know that seems silly, but my brain was like, would a hitchhiker come by? You know, do they, you know, that's a whole nother movie. But yeah, in the real story, like what happens to the guy? Is it just to like, you don't get the girl?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
And I was also juxtaposing that with how we like treat people of color in this country. So I was like, oh, if that person was not a straight white man, I bet something probably terrible would happen to him. But because he's a straight white man and is like handsome and
privileged. Yeah.
He's fine.
He probably paid off the police with the extra dollar from the chocolates.
Yeah. Oh
my probably God. What he did. Or whatever that thing is. I mean, I think it is chocolate because it says confectionery. So it's got to be something.
No, you're totally right. I think I saw a perfume ad. And that's where I got confused because it was like, we sell chocolates, we sell perfume. And so when he bought her that big thing, I was like, I genuinely don't know what that is.
It would be the largest bottle of perfume in the entire world, but it's also the biggest box of chocolates I've seen. So
yeah, I just couldn't tell what it was. And they went to go look at it privately. So we don't see as the audience what it is anyway.
Yeah.
This is just a side note too, but something else I thought of during the 13 ball sequence, I loved that we were talking earlier about how like he's showing us his pool playing skills, his billiard skills, and the bad guys are off to the side describing them, but he foils them. He swaps out the balls. So like, even though it's still Buster Keaton, he was smart enough in that scene to pull a fast one on them, even though they pull fast ones on him all the time.
Yes, it's like he's smart enough and then he gets distracted by the wrong detail and then fails, and then he can always get himself out of it, right? Or somebody gets him, but usually he himself gets out of it. But we have to watch him fail or else there's no comedic tension. So we have to watch him fail over and over and over again. One thing that like in silent movies and stuff, it's like it says poison on the bottle of poison. Like that always strikes me. You know, when we have words, we would just use the words to explain that, but you can't. You don't have time. You have to show the picture of the poison and it's, you know, that's what it is.
And the man drinks the poison and spits it out. And I was like, wouldn't that still harm you? Wouldn't you still have issues?
I mean, it doesn't in the storytelling, but you can see that in his face, it's like, was that bad? You know? And I'm like, yeah, that was, I think it's in your mouth. You know, so I love a spit take too. I do love a spit take.
What's interesting too about this one is that man that's like one of the bad guys in the movie within the movie is not like he's in the real life part, but he's the dad's friend. So it's interesting that Buster's like dreamy brain would take that on of like, you are present, therefore you'll also be the bad guy in my dream.
Yes. My mind at the beginning, I think the first time I saw it, definitely thought he was the boss from the movie theater who treated Buster badly. Oh. And so then I was, you know, but then I realized, oh, then no, that's not the same person. It's two different people. So then, I wondered why that was the enemy.
Yeah.
He had a big role in the movie.
All right. Oh, and the final modern lens thing just in general is I think the awesome technical feats were really, they had so many incredible filmmaking feats that they did here that I was like, that's so cool that you could figure that out when film is a brand new thing.
I 100% agree. Magical. I love so much that it was like 46 minutes.
Yes.
And, you know, I don't care about the movies are too long. I feel like I'm like in the minority about that because everyone's always like, it was so long though. And I'm like, I think I needed that whole movie to be exactly what it was, you know, usually. Yeah. Or people are like, I wish they'd gotten to it faster. I'm like, I'm in the experience. I'm like taken away by it. Let me be there for as long as it needs to be, right? But this is, it like feels like a little delicious piece of cake with like whipped cream on top. And like, it just feels like a perfect little 46 minute long movie. I think it's 46, somewhere around
it
there.
Is, yeah.
Yeah, just feels exactly what it needs to be.
I totally agree. It's like everything is just right. It's exactly correct as it is. Right. And it flies by. It's so much fun. And it means that you could watch two in a row, which, hey, we're now entering our double feature portion of this podcast. If you like this film, check out these other films. Since a lot of Buster Keaton's films are pretty short, you could just do a Buster Keaton double or triple feature and it would be the length of like a full length film, you know? The ones I had mentioned that I've seen The Cameraman, which would probably pair so well with this because it's also about filmmaking.
Agree. And I love that movie. Yep.
And the only reason I didn't choose it for this, I suppose, is because I wanted to watch a new one that I hadn't seen. So I'm so glad that we did. And again, I remember really enjoying Our Hospitality in college and being very impressed by it. I've never seen his most famous one, which is The General. I was a little turned off that he was a Confederate soldier, so I didn't really want to select it for this.
I 100% agree with that. I mean, there's amazing gags in the movie and things like that, but that really bothered me as well when I first saw it. And I saw it a long time ago, and it was like, oof, why are we doing this?
There's that. And we almost, for this viewers at home, we almost watched the film Seven Chances instead of this because I was intrigued by the premise. And it looks good. It looks like it could be very misogynistic and sexist, but at the same time, it also looks like fun.
Yes. And you, I mean, when we were just like talking about it, I have actually never seen that one, which is, it's very rare to find a Buster movie I have not seen, to be honest. And I've seen like pretty much all the shorts and everything. And you were like, oh, he gets like chased down the street by a number of women who are trying to marry him. And I was like, eh, but I will watch.
Yeah. That was ultimately one of the deciding factors of like, but do I want to do that? I prefer mysteries and movies about movies.
Yes.
But it did look intriguing. It's basically he inherits a large sum of money if he gets married within 24 hours. And so he puts an ad in the paper and then everyone is trying to marry him. So, you know, that has a lot of comedic potential. And Steamboat Bill Jr. is apparently very adventure action-y in terms of, I guess there's a lot of insane boat stunts. I haven't seen it either.
I also love 1 Week. I don't know if you've seen 1 Week.
It's a short, isn't it?
It is a short, but there's just so many amazing gags about like the house and, you know, he's always trying to do the right thing. I think that's something in most of his movies, at least, that he's trying to do the right thing for himself and for everyone. He really does think of other people a lot. And in that movie, it's the famous one where the house just falls down around them. And that one apparently had to be timed so perfectly as well, because it's a huge house that just sort of opens and falls and he comes through the window. So if he was like an inch off, you know, he would be crushed by a house. A little appetizer for this movie.
Ooh, so like a little pre-show.
Yeah.
Like we're doing old timey movie day. We watch our pre-show.
Yes.
And then you get to your feature film.
Yes.
Have you seen The Goat? Because that was also on the list of like the top 10 best Buster Keaton ones. I have not seen it.
I have not seen it. So that's another one.
I think it's supposed to be like Buster Keaton is mistaken for like the baddest guy in town.
Yeah, I have not seen it.
I haven't seen it either, but it was on that list. So I was like, okay, worth checking.
That.
There's a list on IMDb of the 10 best Buster Keaton films.
Okay. I will make sure I see that. I was thinking about what movies have this sort of like dream sequence. And of course, like The Wizard of Oz, which I just, you know, it has this like, we're going to Oz and we're, you know, and then we're back home again and sort of has like a little bit of that in this movie, the structure.
Also the technical feats of the time too. So yeah, you're right. The structure, the, you know, we're in our quote unquote real life. We go to our fantasy world and we come back to our real life. Like, yes. And then the advancements in technology. I mean, Technicolor, that's early Technicolor right there.
Side note, if you live in LA and if you have not been to the Academy Museum, you have to go because I cried when I saw the ruby slippers on display.
That exhibit's over now.
They're gone?
Yeah, it's done now. It's The Godfather. But it was The Wizard of Oz and it was wonderful. That was an incredible exhibit. I love that exhibit.
But The Godfather is wonderful too.
Yes, but now it's The Godfather because they're going to update all the exhibits. And so, yeah, I'm so sorry if you've missed it.
Sorry if you missed it. Is there an Agnes Varda exhibit?
There is right now. Yeah. Yeah, it was Spike Lee and now it's Agnes Varda. Yep.
Oh, beautiful.
The Academy Museum is incredible. And I love that they are dedicated to changing it up. Like the exhibits that they opened with were incredible. And I saw them quite a few times and I love them. And their new exhibits are great too. And they're in the process of changing things up. So I like that it's not just going to be a stagnant piece. It's going to be updated throughout the years.
But there's one thing I think is still there, I hope, where you can win an Oscar.
It's still there, the Oscar experience.
Great. Yes. And so I was wearing overalls, unfortunately, and I was with my 6-month-old daughter at the time, but we won an Oscar together and it was pretty spectacular. So I encourage everyone to get your Oscar.
I won an Oscar too. I did. And I'm going to win another one. I have a date to win another one pretty soon.
Get that Oscar,
though. Yeah, we love the Academy Museum. Check it out. It's a wonderful place, especially if you love movies. It's very thoughtfully curated and they do update it. So what you're seeing, the exhibits you're seeing, will only be there for a short time.
Must go.
Oh, and one other, just as a side note of double features, for me, I also wanted to say Singing in the Rain, because to me, that's like a musical about like the movie making process and the love of silent films and transferring to new technology. So obviously Singing in the Rain, check it out. And then if you're into Charlie Chaplin, check out City Lights and Modern Times. If you're like, ooh, I want to do Buster and Charlie. And if you're doing the W.C. Fields double feature, we watched The Bank Dick here. And there's a scene when Buster Keaton's on the dirt bike and people are throwing dirt on him in a gorgeous arc of a line. And W.C. Fields takes that in The Bank Dick and they do that, but with bodies jumping out of a hole that's being dug. So I was like, oh, look at that. comedy homage.
No, but it is so fun to watch. Like, I'm sure they all were like, I love that. How can that influence something that I'm doing? And just the sharing of those bits and everything. So magical.
Oh, and I did not. I love that they call Sherlock Jr. the crime crushing criminologist. That was just another shout out.
Great alliteration.
Everything. I loved it. Perfect. Okay. So yeah, that was our show. Sue Kate, thank you so much for being here. Check out her film Buster Baby, but also Sue Kate, how can people follow you?
Oh my goodness. You can find me at Instagram at Susan_Kate. And I'll at least always post links to stuff I'm working on there. So you can follow me there.
Thank you, Susan Kate Heaney, for being on this show. It was so good to have you.
It was so fun to be here. And I think it's the perfect time too, because Buster is really having a resurgence. Like, the new movie is coming out with Rami Malek as Buster Keaton, and all the tons of Buster books are being published and written. And I think it's just such a great time for everyone to get their eyeballs on my boo, Buster Keaton.
All right. Well, thank you so much. This was a lovely conversation, and we will see you all next time on Talk Classic to Me.
You have been listening to Talk Classic to Me with Sarah Greenfield. That's me. My guest this week was Susan Kate Heaney. They will be featured on our Instagram page. If you enjoyed our show, please introduce a friend and show them how to subscribe, and maybe even find us on anchor.fm to become a contributing member. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Talk Classic to Me for some awesome content and to find out what's coming up next. Thanks for listening.